Thank you for listening to Abstract Illusions Radio. With each breath of air, gain new insights and inspirations as we explore and expose the different aspects of the human experience. Now with your host, Jennifer Hillman. Good evening, everyone. This is Jennifer Hillman, and thank you so much for listening to AIR. Tonight, we have an amazing experience that we're going to discuss, and the implications are huge. Dr. Eben Alexander III has had 25 years as a neurosurgeon and had this amazing experience of going into a coma and having a near-death experience. His experiences during that time were tremendous, and Dr. Eben Alexander, thank you so much for coming out. The implications of having science and spirituality kind of blend and mix is huge. So it's really an honor and a pleasure to have you on.
Well, thank you so much for asking me to be on.
I heard about you through a mutual friend, Michelle D'Souza, who heard your talk back in Virginia and in January, and she just was telling me about it, and as we were talking, it's like, I got to get this guy on. I have to have him on the show. So tell us a little bit about your career in neurosurgery and what exactly happened.
Okay. Well, I started my career back in 1980, finishing medical school at Duke, and then I did my neurosurgical training mainly at Duke, but a few years at Mass General Hospital. And then I went on staff at Harvard Medical School and the Brigham Women's Hospital and Children's Hospital back in early 1988. Spent more than 15 years there, and then spent several years out at UMass in Worcester. Have always been very fascinated with the mechanism of consciousness and what exactly consciousness represents. As a neurosurgeon, I saw many patients who had alterations in their level of consciousness, and many of them who went into coma, and of course, some patients ended up succumbing to their disease. But the ones who returned from coma were not able to really offer me too much insight into the nature of consciousness. And it was really through my own very unexpected near-death experience that I was able to get that kind of exposure.
And let me ask you a question now. Why did you go into neurosurgery? I mean, what was the pull towards that special idea of medicine? I mean,
well,
what was the interest there?
It turns out that, in fact, my father was a neurosurgeon, but believe it or not, because of that, the last thing in the world I was going to go into in my teenage years and when I started my college career was neurosurgery. I thought at some level I'd always be competing with him in the back of my mind, so I really felt like, you know, it was something I wanted to avoid was going to neurosurgery, but I did several jobs in the hospital, and I really fell in love with medicine and taking care of patients. And then in medical school, after I did surgery and especially neurosurgery rotations, I went, oh, my gosh, he was right, because it really was just the most wonderful career and line of work, and I always was very grateful to be in that field. And a lot of patients would come in with really some devastating conditions. I did a lot of work with patients with malignant brain tumors. And, you know, it's very humbling. And I must say that I was grateful for any good results I could get because I had realized long ago that there were forces much more powerful than myself that had to do with good results. And I've never felt that more strongly than I have in the last 2.5 years since I came out of coma.
Now, how strong was your faith before your coma? I mean, what was your, you know, your religious beliefs, your basic idea? I mean, you said that you saw patients at variety of levels of consciousness and that you had an interest in it. Did you have a strong faith?
Well, I grew up in a fairly religious household. My father, as I said, was an academic neurosurgeon, and in fact, he had trained right at the beginning of World War II, and he was a combat surgeon in the Pacific through World War II. And so he had a fairly strong faith. I think that was the only thing that brought him back from that experience in as good shape as he was in. And so that kind of filtered down to me over many years, and I grew up going to church and believing at some level that prayers were answered. But I had a series of events that occurred, especially about 10, 11 years ago, that really interfered with my faith. And in fact, I ended up on something of a downward spiral and was losing my faith, really beginning around the year 2000, and ended up thinking that at best maybe Einstein was right, maybe there was a creative God, but one that was far too busy to be listening to individual prayers. And I had pretty much given up on that concept of an individual God of love, and certainly one who had time for individual prayers by the time I was stricken with my illness in November of 2008. So I had some faith that I think was a reasonable amount. Certainly, being in a very scientific culture and in the medical world, I was a firm believer in kind of the reductionist scientific view, specifically of the nervous system and of the brain and mind. And even though I continued for many years to go to church and wanted to believe in God and wanted to believe that there was life after death, I must say that because of my scientific leaning, I was very hard-pressed to explain how our soul could exist once our brain dies. But I now feel like I have a much clearer view of exactly how all that works.
Now, did that come through your experience of having a coma, correct?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I really, I would be completely... you know, if I had had one of my patients explain to me the story that I'll be telling you in a few minutes, 2.5-3 years ago before my coma, I would have reassured them that, yes, indeed, they were very, very sick. I would have patted them on the shoulder and, oh, yes, and we had you on such powerful drugs. Anything can happen. You know, that's what the brain does when it's in extremis, when it's close to death. And I would have been completely wrong. And I can see that now. But there was no way I would have believed all of this before. But now it all is falling into place and making very good sense to me. And I must say it's reassuring to see how common my kind of experience was. But now, from my viewpoint as a neuroscientist and certainly one who has a long-standing interest in cosmology and physics and how to explain reality, I think it's been very helpful to go through what I went through to help me to see how these things fit together.
Well, and okay, now how did the coma happen? I mean, what was the illness in... Let's go through the process of what happened and just go ahead and explain what you experienced during your coma.
Okay. Well, it was about 4:30 in the morning on Monday, the 10th of November in 2008, and I was getting up, getting ready to go up to work. I was working at the time up in Charlottesville, Virginia, about an hour and 15 minutes drive. And when I got out of bed, I noticed I had very severe back pain. I'd never had that before, and it hit me like a bolt out of the blue. And I could barely take any steps, but was able to get back into bed and lie down. And my wife Holly saw that I was in great distress, and she was massaging my back and trying to make me feel better. And in fact, I didn't know it, but at the time I was already being overrun with a very primitive bacterial infection of my brain and spinal cord. My younger son, his name is Bond, and Bond came in right before school and saw how sick I looked, and he started rubbing my temples to make me feel better. It was at that time that I realized that I had the worst headache imaginable. But, of course, I was already way too far gone to put all this together. My wife noticed that I was, she thought I was drifting off to sleep, finally resting, but I was actually lapsing into coma. And the last words I had said to her were, "Don't call 911. You know, trust me, I'm a doctor. Don't call 911. It's a muscle spasm." And, you know, of course, I was far gone by then. I had no clue what was going on. And she went down to call my colleagues and asked them what she should do. And, in fact, when she came back upstairs, I was having a grand mal seizure on the bed. And so she knew it was time to override any instructions about not calling 911. She made that call, and the EMTs came to hustle me off. And, of course, by that time I was gone. I don't remember anything at all that happened for the next week. So I've had to put the details together from what people have told me. I know that I arrived in the emergency room, and I had a high lactic acid level in my blood, but otherwise no real obvious abnormalities. My white blood cell count was way up, though. It was around 43,000 with a lot of early forms in the white blood cell showing a very acute, severe infection. And I credit my older son, Eben, with my survival. He was 20 years old at the time. He had climbed Mount Cotopaxi down in South America, which is almost 20,000 feet high, back in February, and he was trying to get me in shape to climb that mountain with him. And that had happened over the months preceding my coma onset. I'm very fortunate for that, but it was not so fortunate for the six people who had to hold me down in the emergency room trying to do a lumbar puncture. But when they got the needle in and pus came out, it was obvious that Dr. Laura Potter, my ER physician, who's absolutely wonderful, she was right on the money, and they started three very powerful IV antibiotics right away. I was taken up to the ICU. I was actually put on a ventilator at that point because I was in such extremely bad shape. And in fact, I was so sick through that week that a repeat lumbar puncture showed that my CSF glucose, which normally that's the in the cerebrospinal fluid around the brain and spinal cord, that glucose level in most people is around 60 to 80. And if you're really sick with bacterial meningitis, all the bacteria are eating the glucose, and in the worst cases, it'll drop down maybe into the 20s. Well, in fact, I was so sick with an overwhelming bacterial meningitis that my CSF glucose went down to 1. And
wow.
Between that and looking at my CT scan, which revealed diffuse swelling over my entire cerebral cortex, over the entire surface of my brain, and also some loss of what's called the gray-white junction and a lot of swelling. I mean, it was very clear that I was extremely sick with this, and I was not responding to the antibiotics at all. And at times when they would lighten my sedation, I really wouldn't do much of anything. I still had some signs of brainstem activity, so I never got to what is called brain death. But I was extremely sick with a very poor neurologic grade, and they kept shifting the antibiotics, trying to make something work. But even after 6 days, I was just deeper in coma, and I think the doctors were really ready to give up. My son had been there to visit. He drove down from University of Delaware, my son Eben, the older one, and my wife Holly was there with me. My mother had come up from North Carolina. My sisters, Jean, Betsy, and Phyllis, were all there. And they were just having to adjust to the fact that I was going to die, that they were going to lose me. There were prayer groups going up in Boston and with friends all over. You know, they were all getting used to the fact that this was just looking terrible and nothing was going the right way. It was very depressing for them, and it was especially tough for me to hear about all this when I came back. But you know, it was a very challenging disease. And one other thing I should mention about it is by the first morning that I was there in the hospital, the day after I arrived, they discovered that I had E. coli, Escherichia coli, which really, if you do a medical literature search, spontaneous cases of E. coli meningitis in adults, you'll find that they are extremely rare. E. coli meningitis really occurs in newborns. It's very rare for it to occur in anyone over 3 months of age. And that was just a gigantic mystery. And in fact, we never found a reason why I would have such a completely bizarre bacterial infection. I had been, as part of my work, I had been to Israel to visit a company. I was supporting a medical technology that I thought was going to be very revolutionary, which is called focused ultrasound, and had gone to Israel to visit a company that's prominent in that field. And it turns out that my physicians were quite excited by that piece of news because I'd gone there just a few months before my illness because there had recently been a strain of a very resistant E. coli in the Middle East. But it turns out that on further testing, that was not the E. coli I had. So I may have picked up something, you know, traveling and walking through the streets of Old Jerusalem, but it was certainly not my E. coli.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you a quick question. How prevalent or how many people survive meningitis overall when it gets this type of meningitis?
Okay, well, the turns out that many, when people hear meningitis, it turns out that the majority of cases, about four times as many, are caused by virus, often what can be called an aseptic meningitis. And that's four times as common as the more deadly bacterial meningitis. And the good news is the viral meningitis is only about 1% fatal. The problem with bacterial meningitis, it's much less common, thank God, because the mortality rate is 100% if it's untreated. And even if it's treated very quickly with appropriate IV antibiotics, the mortality rate is going to be between about 25 and 40%, depending on the series. So it's still extremely deadly. I certainly have not heard of a case, nor have any of the consultants or people who were aware of my case, where somebody was in coma from bacterial meningitis for 6 days, especially being so sick that the CSF glucose was down to one and my neurologic exam was so poor and such a bad-looking CT scan. Nobody that I've ever heard of has been able to survive that and make a full recovery. I think occasionally people might live through it, but even when I was first waking up, my physicians told my family that I would probably need 2 to 3 months in the hospital and in rehab and then would need chronic care in a nursing home for the rest of my life. And it was a complete shock to everybody over the next few weeks. After I did start to come around, that I had a complete recovery. So it really was just a really blessed miracle, and I am just filled with gratitude for that miracle.
Of course. So what happened? Where did you go when you were in the coma? You have no consciousness of what was going on around you, outside of you. So what was going inside of you?
Well, it's very interesting. As a neuroscientist, I can tell you that memory is one of the most demanding functions of the brain. So, in fact, it's really surprising that I remember anything, but I certainly can talk about the things I do remember. And I've assumed that what I remember is only the tip of the iceberg, and that, in fact, there was probably a lot more experience I had that I don't remember. But I will tell you how it all started. I was aware of just existing in what I now call kind of the earthworm's eye view. It was very murky, dark, kind of brownish reds, boiling mud. I felt like I was underground. I had absolutely no memory whatsoever of my life or of humans on Earth or of our anything in our universe. I had no memory of any of that. No memory of words, no language. Everything was gone. All I had was an awareness of just existing in what I recall as a gross, coarse, kind of pounding, throbbing, underground place. I have a very distinct recollection of roots up above me. And it seemed that I was there for months. I mean, it's very difficult to put any kind of a time label on it. All I can tell you is that my memory is that I was there for a very, very long time. Of course, my coma only lasted 7 days, so in reality, I was not there more than 7 days. But that gross, murky, coarse, pounding, underground, ugly realm, occasionally there would be kind of a macabre face that would kind of boil up out of the murk, an animal face that would roar, chant, and then it would vanish back into the murky mud. It was as if I was trying to look at things through a window pane during a huge rainstorm in the middle of the night and trying to make out what was outside. And just, it was all just gross and dark. It sounds kind of foreboding to talk about it, but in fact, I had no memory of anything else. So in fact, I just accepted that it was existence, and that was that. Mm-hmm. And then I had the most incredibly beautiful interruption of that very prolonged, murky underground. And it came in the form of a melody that was spinning right in front of me. And I later came to see it as some kind of a hymn or prayer or something, although I didn't understand any words. But it was a beautiful melody, and it just came and it spun in front of me. And as it did, it was like sunlight shining down into a misty valley in the morning. And it just cleared everything away. It was like waking up from a dream. Waking up, I mean, even this earthly existence is dreamlike compared to that crisp, sharp, beautiful, brilliant reality as I woke up and saw a beautiful landscape. And it turns out I had no body image at all at that point. And I was a speck on a butterfly wing, and there was a beautiful butterfly, and there were millions of other butterflies of all different indescribable bright colors, changing patterns, flying all around me, and we were looping through budding flowers and you know, blooms and blossoms, and they would open up even as we flew right by them. And there was a beautiful girl sitting beside me on the butterfly wing. And she was dressed in an old kind of a peasant, I later came to see it as a 10th century outfit that she was wearing. And that's where she'd come from. Although at the time, of course, I had no concept of centuries or human history or anything. Mm-hmm. But there was a beautiful girl sitting right beside me. And she didn't say anything, but she was smiling, and her thoughts came into my mind. And she was telling me through these thoughts, "You are greatly loved. There's nothing you can do wrong. You are cherished and loved. You will not be thrown away." And it was the most comforting and beautiful experience to have her there, just sending me these warm waves of loving comfort. And much later, as I was coming out of all this, I started to call her my guardian angel. And I could remember her very well. But of course, at the time when I was there on the butterfly wing, I had no words whatsoever. I had no no ability to form words and had no memory of any concept like a guardian angel. So I came to call her that later, and I'm quite convinced that's exactly what she was. And then there was this soft, warm, like a summer breeze that blew through, and everything changed. Although it seemed the same, still the butterflies, the colors, beautiful waterfalls going into pools with light sparkling through the mist and the droplets and the flowers of indescribable colors. All the beauty was there, but it changed because I became, and again, in retrospect, I see this, I became aware of divinity. And again, that word was not in my mind at that time, but it was an awareness that all of a sudden, all of this was very touched and spiritual and divine. And in fact, my awareness that God had come into that awareness of myself on that butterfly wing. And from that point, we went outside of this universe into what I call the core, which initially seemed like an infinitely vast space. And it was so vast that, in fact, I was accompanied at that point by God and by an orb of light. And for a long time, I assumed that the orb of light was my guardian angel, but I don't really know that that's the case. All I know is that there was an awareness that three of us were there, and it was God and the orb and my awareness. And again, my awareness, though, was like the awareness of all living consciousness everywhere. It was not an individual person's awareness. This was much, much bigger than my own consciousness. And it was, they told me that there were things they would show me, but that I would be going back. And I didn't really know what that meant because I had no idea what back was back to, but they showed me many things about the universe and how it was put together. I remember having the entire multiverse right in front of me, like this big, extremely complex ball that I could kind of manipulate. Now, again, I had no body image whatsoever, but with my mind, I could manipulate it, go down inside of it, see how time was all wrapped up inside. And in fact, time in that outer realm was very, very different. Time inside that multiverse ball that I was examining this whole time was all wrapped up tightly, almost as if it was wrapped into a point. It was very strange and hard to understand, but cause and effect are still very important in that outer realm. And what I could see was that they had to do with the ascendance of our souls in that outer realm, but that the what we see as time is really something of a fiction. And it was all made very clear, and things, concepts were just poured into me that all seemed crystal clear. Such things as dark energy and dark matter, all this was spelled right out in front of me, how it all worked and was put together. It was all geometry. And what would happen is they would show me these lessons, and then I would find myself drifting and drifting, and I'd be back out in that coarse, ugly, underground, earthworm's eye view place again. And what I learned to do, though, was I could remember a few of the notes of that spinning melody that had initially taken me to that beautiful, hyper-real, loving realm. And I could recall those notes, and it would help me to move back up into that beautiful clarity, into the, what I call the gateway, that beautiful place with the flowers and the waterfalls and all, and then back out to the core. And they would remind me that I was not going to be staying. And several times I had that kind of back and forth where I would find myself back into the ugly underground, and I would then start to remember the melody. And it would take me back into that brilliant light of that clear valley and the butterfly wing, and then back out to the core. But then I found that it didn't work anymore, and that they had promised that I was not, that I would be going back. So I knew I was going back somewhere. By that time, I had tremendous faith that wherever it was that I was going, that they would take care of me, that I didn't have to fear it. I will say I was very sad that I found I could not remember the melody and get back into the beautiful heavenly place. And in fact, it was that time when I was really sad and realizing that that one little bit of control that I seemed to have over anything, that is when I became aware of being buoyed up on beautiful billowing prayers. And I became aware of people around me kneeling, going off in arcs off into the darkness in the far distance. And some of them had candles and they were all kneeling and I could hear prayers. I couldn't understand any words, but I could hear kind of this murmuring coming in from all these people that were surrounding me going off into the far distance. And it was making these beautiful, soft clouds of light that were billowing me up and up and up. And they were so totally comforting. All of that love that I had seen deep inside the gateway and the core, because one of the things that was so striking when I was seeing the multiverse and realizing all that about the physical universe was that, in fact, it was made up almost entirely of love. And that was such a remarkable part of my journey. There was no denying it. And there were very obvious little specks, impurities, throughout the multiverse. And even when I could look, peer down towards Earth, I could see that there were specks of impurity. And the impurity, I was told, that was evil, and that evil was critical for what our souls have to do in their ascendance in the outer realm. And that was something that was also very, very clear when I was in there, and I've really wrestled with that as I've tried to put this whole thing together. But the love, that's probably one of the most beautiful parts of the whole journey, is that love was a fundamental part of the makeup of this entire universe and had everything to do with what our souls' mission is throughout their ascendance in the outer realm. And in particular, fits into what we are to do during our brief journey here on Earth. Part of what our souls have to do has to do with nothing more than giving out that beautiful love that's part of the creative core of the universe.
Okay, so with that, if the main thing, but nothing more than giving out love, then what is the darkness and the evil? Is it like challenging us to keep that love and continuing it outpouring?
Yes. Well, it as I said, as I slowly started to come back from all this, because on the seventh day of my coma, I actually did start waking up, and it was just a complete shock to everyone. And as I was coming out of all this, the only thing I could remember was where I had been, that coarse, ugly underground realm, and then also the beautiful gateway and the core. And I had no memory of anything else. But over the next week or so, as my memories of my previous life started coming back, and especially all of the memories I had of the of my neurosurgical training and dealing with coma patients and the neuroscience of consciousness and all those parts, it kept saying, no, this couldn't have happened. This could not have happened. And in fact, I initially, although I was completely blown away by the power and the reality of the spiritual experience, I was thinking, well, I have to report this as, in a neuroscientific fashion. I have to somehow explain how all that could happen in a scientific way. Although, at first it seemed like a very daunting task because the reality of the spiritual experience was so extreme. But I thought there's got to be a way to explain this scientifically, and so that's what I was trying to do. But it was something that was extremely difficult to get my arms around. I talked it over with several neuroscientists, and we came up with several hypotheses. But going back and reviewing my medical records, looking at my scans, seeing just how sick I was, it just was impossible to come up with a good neuroscientific explanation. And, of course, as I said earlier, if one of my patients had gone through this experience and described it to me, I would have just assumed that, of course, it couldn't really happen. And yet I know that it was extremely real. And the other thing that makes it kind of dumbfounding is the fact that meningitis is probably the very best model you could dream up to mimic human death. It's so much better than things like head trauma or a stroke or brain hemorrhage, any of those things, because it globally knocks out the neocortex, the outer surface of the brain, that part which makes us human, which incidentally is the part that allows us to have visual experience, auditory experience, to have language, to put all these things together in our world into a conscious view of reality. And that's why my situation is so completely stunning, because none of this should have been able to happen at all in my brain. Mm-hmm. And I think the implications of that, especially of being trained in neuroscience and also knowing a fair amount about physics and cosmology and trying to explain reality, this becomes really a very kind of a remarkable story that I think tells us a whole lot about our existence in this universe.
So with this experience, it definitely has changed your outlook on what's really important in life, would you say?
Oh, totally. I mean, it's just been a beautiful gift in every sense of the word. As I had said, my faith had really been shaken and was going down, and I thought there was no way that there could be a loving God who'd listen to individual prayers. And what I've come to realize is, of course, that there is a loving, creative God, far more advanced than we ever could have dreamed based on our religious writings, who is most interested exactly in loving our individual souls. And that became so, so clear to me on this journey. It's I think a big part of what I've been trying to do is to put all this in the context of modern science and show how it's all totally consistent with modern science. That's a huge part of what I'm trying to do in the book I'm writing about this whole experience. But it has shown me the eternity of our souls, the fact that love is really the primary ingredient of all of this, the power of prayer, which I never, or I should say in the years leading up to this, I had really given up on, but I came to realize that my prayers were answered, but they could be answered in ways that were very different from what I thought. And in fact, the way I look at it now is I was just praying for the wrong things, but that God, in fact, knew that there were ways that my life should evolve that were much more important, and that the prayers were indeed answered. I cannot say that the prayers of, you know, people in those prayer groups, I cannot say that that's what brought me back. As a physician, I know of many cases where we had patients and a lot of wonderful people with a strong faith and belief in an Almighty were praying, you know, from all different religions, and yet I could see that patient did not make it back. So I cannot say that the prayers brought me back. What I can certainly say is that I was brought back because God has some plan for me. And I can tell you that the prayers brought great comfort to me. I mean, tremendous comfort when my soul was in that place where it was. I was very frightened. I could not get back to that beautiful heavenly spiritual place. I knew I was going back somewhere. I didn't know where it was. The prayers were extremely comforting, and they got through, and they were they are very, very powerful. I obviously have now know that God is very real, and have no fear of death, and just have gratitude for every single breath. And of course, I had a purpose before in life, and I know I should have had gratitude for every breath before, because it is a miracle that any of us are alive. And I guess it took this experience to show me that light. I now see the love in everyone's soul and know that we are all in this together. And this is not just about humans. This animals, I mean, there is love of life and consciousness pervading the entire multiverse, and it's a love and respect for all of this that comes from this journey.
Now, if you were to tell somebody on their spiritual journey the best way to handle or deal with their challenges, what would you say to them? Mm-hmm. What would your advice be if it seems like, you know, everything that's happening to them is really making them, as you were, doubting your faith. Yet they just have this, there's a faith and it's unknowing, but yet they're on that spiritual path to figure this all out. Is there one thing that you would really recommend to them to understand? Is it basically, what would it be?
Well, I now know to embrace hardship and challenge, that often they are the answer to prayers that I might not have appreciated before. And I firmly believe that God never gives us more than we can handle. I admit that sometimes that can be extremely difficult, but by having faith in God and in God's love, I know that I can get through anything. And I don't look at the hardship as an unanswered prayer, because often that is how God helps us to grow. I have found that by simply knowing that God is right there, a little prayer asking for his help to get through any situation always helps me do better. I also know that if there's ever any question about what I should do in any situation, all I have to do is know that my soul is here to give out the love of God to all my fellow souls, and that that will help me to do the right thing. God is very real, and I think the evidence to us, when I started reading about near-death experiences, and I've done a lot of reading on cosmology and physics, and it's all consistent with where we're going now with some of the most extreme science, mm-hmm. that this whole realm is very, very possible. And I know that God is there, and that God is of pure love for all of us. And it is simply my position as a soul, as a loving soul, as part of really what's a universal soul of all of us in this together, is to help give that loving light out to other souls. And just to know that loving God is there. It's amazing how many people have come up to me after I've given presentations on this and told me about how they were in an extreme situation of hardship, of deep prayer, meditation. These things can all get us there, but especially the stories of people who were in a very tough place with extreme challenges in their life and just on their knees and in prayer and feeling his hand on their shoulder. And I know that that is real. I know that he comes when we really need him, and when we ask, he's there.
Now, what are your perceptions, your thoughts on the power of surrender, of surrendering a hardship to God and saying, okay, I know you can help me? Is that prayer, in a sense of surrendering it over to God, saying, I can't do this alone. I need you. I'm giving this to you to help me, guide me through this.
Very much so. Very, very much that is the case. I mean, I certainly know of examples since I went through all this where I felt like I had a difficult problem. And just by turning that problem over and knowing that that loving God will take care of it, that works. An important thing often is to get my ego out of the way. The ego and that little kind of voice of, you know, reason in our head puts itself up on a pedestal, and it really doesn't belong on that pedestal. And I think that's an important thing for, certainly it's been important for me to really come to understand. I think you make a very good point that often surrendering and turning things over and you know, just putting our ego in a back room and closing the door and just letting the right things happen and turning it over to God, I think that works extremely well, especially in very tough situations. Obviously, God helps those who help themselves, so it's also important to do our best to try and get the outcomes we want. But it's critical to know that often turning things over is the best way to get the right answers and get the right things to happen. And to have faith in the souls of others, I think, is also very key. Because the more we each expect and understand the love that's in the others around us, the more I think that love comes pouring over all of us.
Yes, and as you have mentioned many times, truly be grateful for any soul who comes into your life, because to me at least, every person who's come into my life, there's a reason for it, being agreement, being they're a hidden angel in some form. So I always show gratitude to everybody who comes into my life because they are a blessing one way or another. Even if there's someone who is putting me in that tight spot, they're really helping me grow.
Right. That is so true. I think I have become much more open to realizing that I would say especially with strangers, I just find that by being open to them and just open to a simple conversation, often it seems that they are put there for a reason to help me grow at a certain level, and they're often just like angels sent to give me, the next stone to building the pathway. Right. And there is just a wonderful love that comes to us when we're open to it, and a lot of that has to do with all of our relationships with friends, and also with people, as you point out, who may not seem to be so friendly to us. But I remember hearing long ago there was something in the Bible about praying for your enemy, which to me didn't seem to make a lot of sense, but it makes tremendously more sense now. And I realized that all of us have some goodness in our souls, and that if you're opening yourself to getting that love and goodness from people, even if at one point they may seem like they're not having much love to give you, I think we'll find that we'll attract more and more of it. And if everybody were doing that, I think it would be a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right. Now, the other question, you brought up the ego. What is the purpose of the ego? I mean,
well, I think the ego is very important to survival for certainly for I don't want to stretch the definition of ego from a psychiatric standpoint, but I think in the evolution of animals,
what became the ego in what became the ego in humans had to do with survival, and I think that has been very important in survival of individuals and survival of the species. But it turns out that it can get in the way. In a higher civilization, it can certainly, the kind of
competitive attitude that often comes with that ego and the obsessions and there are just a lot of things that work against the principles of this sharing of love that are can really be a problem. And I think that that is a key thing to understand. And the ego, certainly that, as I mentioned, that thinking voice can be an issue. That's kind of the rational brain that I used to think was kind of the pinnacle of human intellectual achievement, but that is not really true. There's a tremendous amount kind of in the subconscious and more intuitive parts of the brain and mind that are very powerful mm-hmm. sources of truth, and yet, it's not something we can easily tap into, and it's not something that is very provable in a scientific sense. But I think a lot of that, and some of that is achieved through meditation, through prayer, things like that. A lot of that part of our consciousness and awareness is very important, and that is clearly something that's above and beyond anything the ego is trying to do for individual survival.
So basically, the ego is just to make sure that, I'm trying to find the balance within the ego, because there's so many spiritual people that says you have to get rid of the ego to really be in the right place. And yet, for me, it's like you got to have a really nice balance, because the ego can also be the motivator to get you to that place.
Well, I think you're right that you need a balance. I think the ego still serves a purpose in our kind of day-to-day living and in helping us to take care of ourselves and take care of our families and groups with which we associate. But there's certainly a lot of what happens in meditation and in prayer. And in very difficult times where the ego, I think, and some of the fear that's associated with the loss that the ego perceives and the ego losing its sense of control, that actually interfere with our doing the right thing. And so in that sense, as you point out, the balance is very critical to achieve. And I think even when our ego is in control, if we're attentive to the that voice, the consciousness that is really at a more fundamental level of awareness than the ego is, I think that helps us to do the right things and to have the power to have the right insights and intuition about things that we need to know to make decisions and to do the right thing.
So I have found for me, I trust my intuition more from my feelings than what I hear in my head. It's like sometimes, my guidance will say, you need to do this, but they always follow it up with a feeling, like a happiness, like an urgency, like you really need to do this. Mm-hmm. And if I just hear it in my head, it's like, okay, is that my ego? I kind of like the discernment. So do you feel that people should trust their feelings a little more than what they're hearing in their head?
I think people should trust feelings and intuitions about things and certainly be aware when the ego, when a self-centered ego is running the show.
Right.
So a lot of that awareness that comes through meditation and prayer and from realizing that there is an all-loving God, totally unconditionally loving God at the core of everything that is right in our universe, and trying to have that awareness and that connection to damper the ego if it's getting a bit out of control or wandering too far from the right path. Mm-hmm. I think often we have to really go with our gut and our feelings. Those are important clues as to what's going on in our world and how we are to interact with people. But I think trying to maintain the balance that you had talked about earlier is very important.
And you are in the process. Our time is running short, which I knew it would go awfully fast. So you're in the midst of writing a book about your wonderful experiences, true?
Yes, I am, and I'm very excited. I've gotten tremendous feedback from people who have heard these talks, and that includes physicians and psychiatrists, psychologists, hospice nurses, lots of people in various stages of faith, some having no faith and some having very strong faith, but very good feedback from people. I think a lot of what I have to say will help people who are struggling with a reconciliation of science and spirituality, because in my view, science and spirituality belong hand in hand, and that's how we will get our very best understanding and meaning from the world in the future, is with science and spirituality having a very healthy relationship. Part of that is realizing that our science is very, very primitive, mm-hmm. extremely primitive compared to that realm. And the very hubris of physicists talking about a theory of everything is almost laughable, except for the fact that many people believe that. They believe that science is on the verge of everything. And if that everything doesn't include the automatic need for that spiritual realm and God, then it can be very damaging, just because people think, well, where does all that fit in? And what I can tell you, and I'll make it very clear in my book, is how it fits in beautifully, and how our science is just woefully primitive. Stephen Weinberg had said that the more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it seems meaningless, and I would reassure him that we will never run out of the incomprehensibility, and we will not run out of this wondrous love for the unknown and for the loving spirit that created it all.
And trusting it.
Yes, exactly.
That's a big lesson.
It is, but I think I should be able to paint that in a fairly clear manner. That certainly is what I gather from the presentation so far.
I am sure you will. Now, you have a wonderful website. How can people get more information about your presentations, your book, and if they want to follow you, how can they follow you?
Yes, my website is www.reconciliationlife.com. Reconciliation Life is one word. They can follow me on Twitter. There I am, Reconciliation L. That's one word. And on Facebook, join the group Reconciliation Life. Again, that's just one word on Facebook. And that's where I will keep people advised as to presentations. That's how they can contact me. And updates on the book, which I am still writing, but am hopefully very close to finishing. I'll keep the updates on that website and on the Twitter and Facebook, Reconciliation L and Reconciliation Life. And that's how they can keep up.
That's excellent. And Dr. Ibram Alexander, you have an amazing wealth of information. I look forward to your book coming out. You just feeling your energy, the amount of love that comes through your voice, even talking with you on Skype, it is amazing the amount of love. So I thank you for sharing that love and your information. It's wonderful.
Well, thank you so much for asking me, Jen. And it's just such a beautiful message, and I just want to give it out to everybody and have everyone know this incredible love. I really think that there is a change in global consciousness coming on us, and I think we all will have a very beautiful future as we all accept this.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And with this is Jennifer Hellman saying, with each breath of air, gain new insights and inspirations. Until next time, many blessings and good night.